Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 4,000 people in Central Ohio live with HIV. Despite remarkable advances in treatment, HIV and AIDS continue to take a tremendous toll. Now a new breakthrough in prevention has emerged. Joining us is the medical director of the Columbus Public Health Sexual Health Clinic and assistant professor at Ohio State University, Dr. Jose A. Bazan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The new drug is called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. Some doctors are calling it a game changer. Why?
Well, so let me actually clarify something first. The name of the drug is actually Truvada. The pre-exposure prophylaxis is just an overarching name for the strategy that we are using to prevent HIV transmission. Okay.
And okay.
This truly is a game changer, like you correctly pointed out, because we have now data from multiple trials, large trials that have demonstrated that taking this medication can actually prevent someone from becoming HIV infected. So so that's why we're very excited about it.
How does it work? Why is it working?
Well, so, this medication is not new, actually. Mm-hmm. We've been using Truvada, which is actually a combination of two drugs, one called tenofovir, the other one called emtricitabine. In this combination, we've actually used it for the treatment of HIV for over 10 years now. So it has a proven track record of being a good drug. It's first line for the treatment of infection in a lot of patients. But, and what we found is that this medication, when you give it to patients who are HIV negative, it can actually prevent them from getting infection. So it actually prevents the virus from getting a hold of the body. And this was actually approved, the medication Truvada was approved in 2012 to be used as PrEP. And the Center for Disease Control and Prevention came out with some guidelines in 2014 to help providers, get on board with PrEP. So, but unfortunately, we just have not seen providers and the community in general just take it up as we would have expected.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a new drug. It's called Truvada. It's a pre-exposure prophylaxis, and some doctors are calling it a game changer when it comes to preventing the spread of HIV and AIDS. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm talking with Dr. Jose Bazan. He's medical director of the Columbus Public Health Sexual Health Clinic. He said that it hasn't been picked up by as many people as they thought. Why do you think?
Well, there's a couple reasons for that. And, usually we try to break it down, reasons for providers and then also for patients. So, when we think about patients, some of them may not know or be aware of their own risk for HIV. They may not be aware that PrEP or the concept of PrEP even exist or how they can actually access it. A lot of them may not have access to medical care. When you think about who is getting HIV, you're thinking about a young patient population, especially racial and ethnic minorities. Lack of insurance is obviously a big concern. Some individuals may, not have the ability of, to take a daily pill. And also, I think there's some stigma associated with PrEP, HIV, and sexual orientation in general. From a provider standpoint, you may be surprised. There's a lot of providers out there that perhaps are not aware of PrEP or may not be familiar with the drug Truvada itself. While, those of us in the infectious disease community who treat a lot of HIV patients know this drug very well, a lot of our other providers may not. There may also be some perceptions regarding how complex the follow-up or the counseling needs to be when talking about PrEP. So that may actually, sort of push some providers away when it comes to doing PrEP. Some providers in general may just feel awkward or, what I call the out of their comfort zone in bringing up such sensitive topics, especially like sexual health and sexual practices.
And it's not just sexual health and sexual practices. IV drug users are highly at risk.
That is correct. So, you know, this drug, you know, like I said, has been approved for PrEP, not only in high-risk individuals of getting HIV, like sexually active men who have sex with men, heterosexual men and women, but also among individuals who engage in intravenous drug use, especially sharing needles with partners of unknown HIV status or partners that are known to be HIV positive. So,
how well does Truvada work? What's the percentage? Do you have it that nailed down?
Well, we do. So, you know, like I said, there's been multiple large randomized clinical trials, multinational trials done in, you know, in a variety of continents. And what we have found in a lot of these trials is that, you know, patients do experience, you know, significant reduction in the incidence or the risk of getting HIV. And in fact, among the patients that we can confirm that they actually take the medication, we have seen protection rates up in the 90% or higher. And that's one of the things that, you know, kind of blew us away in the most recent HIV conference in Seattle was that, you know, when these numbers were presented, you know, we were all in awe about how good of a protection this drug can offer among those who take the medication.
How do you know? I mean, I'm sure it's covered in the studies, but I mean, aren't people who are having, you know, they engage in the kind of lifestyles that make them a vulnerable population, aren't they already taking precautions?
That is a great question. You know, so one of the concerns that, you know, providers have is that there's a perception that if you know, by administering PrEP, that you would give a green light for individuals to engage in high-risk behavior or in more high-risk behavior. Mm-hmm. But the thing to remember is that a lot of these individuals, you know, they qualify for PrEP because they are already engaging in high-risk behavior. And the trials actually showed that when you put, you know, folks on PrEP, they actually did not practice, you know, any more higher risk behavior than patients who were in the placebo arm. In fact, in some of the studies, especially the IPREX study, we saw that patients started to engage in less risky behavior and started using more protection. And the point of this is to, you know, to recognize that PrEP is just not only giving a medication and be on your merry way, okay? Mm-hmm. PrEP is actually a comprehensive package in which patients are seen very frequently, almost on a three-month basis. They are regularly screened for HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. We do counseling regarding what the risk behaviors are for getting HIV, and we try to find ways to try to reduce those risks, and we also discuss adherence. The ultimate goal is that, you know, you provide PrEP during the periods of highest risk, but eventually if you're able to curb some of the behavior, reduce the risk that is putting these patients at risk for HIV in the first place, you know, eventually those patients may be able to come off PrEP.
If they can survive that period of time.
Exactly.
During the high risk period. You mentioned earlier that some physicians may not be putting it out there as much because of the follow-up and counseling that's needed. Is that part of that comprehensive package you were talking about?
That is part of that. And, you know, that's why we are at Columbus Public Health making a big push to educate physicians, providers out in the community, you know, who are seeing these patients. You know, we are holding education sessions, providing material. We have set up a website with a lot of information because, again, we want providers to get on board with this. At the same time, we also recognize that some providers may ultimately not feel comfortable in doing this, but we want them to know that there's also the option to refer their patients. So we at Columbus Public Health have reached out to various local providers here in the community, like the AIDS Research Center or ARC Ohio, the Family AIDS Clinic and Educational Services Program, or the FACES Clinic at Nationwide Children's Hospital, and the Infectious Disease Clinic here at The Ohio State University, and we are more than willing to accept patients in consultation or referral to discuss PrEP.
You mentioned that cost is an issue as well for some people.
Right.
Would this be covered by Medicaid?
So, you know, government insurance programs are starting to cover PrEP. You know, there's still maybe some variability from state to state, but I think the overarching message that we're trying to provide is that I think insurances are getting on board with PrEP. Also, for those uninsured patients, the maker of the drug, Gilead, has a patient assistance program that we are encouraging providers and patients to talk about and discuss. Again, I think financial costs, you know, could pose a significant barrier, but I think, you know, we're encouraging patients and providers to look into it first, and, you know, they may be surprised. They may ultimately be able to afford the medication.
How expensive is it?
So this drug, you know, may end up being somewhere over $1,000 a month.
That's
expensive.
It's
not a cheap drug. It is an expensive drug.
Is that because of the follow-up requirements, or is it just the pill itself? Is it a pill?
It is a pill. Mm-hmm. So it is a pill, you know, that is, you know, a combination of two drugs. But, you know, there are other costs, obviously, you correctly pointed out. You know, those patients, like I said, we try to follow them on an every 3-month basis. There is laboratory testing that is done during these follow-up visits. So it can come at a cost. But again, I think ultimately this is a discussion that, you know, physicians just need to initiate mm-hmm. with their patients.
I guess the question is, how much does it save us in the long run if it's employed? It's sort of like the dream drug. If people were around back in the early 80s when so many people were dying into the 90s, this was the sort of thing we dreamed about.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, cost-effective, you know, analysis and studies, you know, are, I'm sure, are being done and undertaken. But, you know, ultimately, you know, you have to think about it, you know, if you can provide PrEP for, you know, a certain amount of time, you know, a period of highest risk, and then prevent a lifelong infection, which you're going to have to treat basically for the rest of your life if you were to become infected, you know, that's how I would pitch it to providers and patients.
So what are you doing in launching this campaign about the benefits? What's it going to look like?
Well, so we started, you know, our campaign is called Prep Yourself, you know, and we are being very aggressive. We held a press conference on Monday, which was aired in multiple TV news media. Mm-hmm. We're also doing newspaper. Obviously, we're doing radio shows. We are sending alert letters to over 10,000 providers here in Central Ohio, and we're also doing word of mouth. So again, we're trying to be comprehensive and aggressive in getting the word out.
Well, I thank you for sharing your time with us today to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Dr. Jose Bazan. He's medical director for the Columbus Public Health Sexual Health Clinic and an assistant professor at Ohio State University. Warm Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Not everyone loves a trip to the dentist, and perhaps even fewer relish the thought of someone with not a lot of experience pulling a tooth or filling a cavity. But mid-level dental practitioners are expanding access to dental care in Ohio and around the nation, where there is traditionally a shortage. Joining us in the studio is author and senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity, Wendell Potter. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Ann.
Wendell Potter will be speaking in Columbus tonight at the Broad Street Presbyterian Church. For more information, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides for more details. You've called the lack of dental care one of the biggest healthcare crises in our country. Why is that?
You know, it's not on many people's radar screens, and it wasn't on mine until fairly recently. But we have about 130 million people in this country who do not have dental benefits. Far more people lack dental coverage than medical coverage. And the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, doesn't do much to expand coverage. Some more children are covered, but many, many Americans don't have coverage. And an even greater problem is that as many as 50 million Americans live in areas where there are not nearly enough dentists, whether they live in rural areas or inner cities.
Right. I mean, dental coverage is not typical anyway. Even if you have great healthcare
That's
coverage,
right.
you still have to pay extra for dental coverage. That's typical.
That's
but
typical.
Just pure access is a big problem for a lot of people.
It absolutely is a big problem. And this really got on my radar screen when I was back home in Tennessee a few years ago, and I read something about something called a healthcare expedition that was being held nearby, actually in Wise County, Virginia. And people drove from miles and miles to get care there. I thought it was just primarily for medical care, but I learned later that two-thirds of the people who come to these big outdoor events are there to get dental care. It is that much of a crisis. And it's because various reasons. Dental care is much more expensive than it used to be. Few people have dental coverage, as I mentioned. And a lot of people who have benefits find that it's just not adequate. There's an annual limit on how much they will your coverage will cover. And a lot of the big ticket items, you don't get much coverage for at all.
Exactly. So where are all the dentists? Whatever price they might charge, they're not. Where are the shortages the worst, I guess?
Well, they congregate in fairly wealthy suburban areas. Dental school is expensive these days. Students are coming out with—
It's a medical degree.
It's exactly. Mm-hmm. And they have $300,000 and $400,000 in student debt. So they're not likely to set up practice in a rural area. That's why we have thousands of communities that are considered dental deserts around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Ohio, about 1.5 million people don't have easy access to dental care, and that's replicated all over the country. And that's why we need to have some kind of a solution that helps to bridge the gap. Because a lot of people are just not able to get to the cities, even if they have the money.
Now, there are those dental clinics popping up, for-profit clinics around the country. They're not filling the gap?
Not nearly enough. And probably because we don't have enough dentists. There aren't enough dentists who are graduating from schools to actually make up for the dentists that are retiring. A lot of the dentists are, I think the average age is 55, and many of them are retiring. And that's why I've come across the idea, not my idea, but it's one that's been endorsed by people like Dr. Louis Sullivan, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services, and that is to expand the dental workforce to include mid-levels. And I've seen them in practice in Alaska and Minnesota, and now Maine recently has enabled mid-levels to practice there. It's something that is happening in many parts of the country.
What do you mean by a mid-level dental practitioner? It's called a dental therapist. Is it a dentist or some hybrid?
Well, it's comparable to a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant in assistant medical care, and it is a trained person who gets at least 2 years of practice in a particular scope of practice that includes prevention and screenings and cleanings. Up to simple extractions and fillings. There is a specific scope of practice. Beyond that, the dental therapist, if they encounter a patient with a more complex problem, they refer that patient to a dentist, and they work under the supervision of a dentist at all times.
Now, this improves access. This gives puts more people in the driver's seat when it comes to taking care of dental issues for people. But what about cost?
It can be much more cost effective, and a lot of people can also get coverage in the Medicaid program. A lot of dentists don't participate in the Medicaid program because they don't think it reimburses them adequately enough. But mid-levels they don't make nearly as much money as dentists, so they're much better able to take on patients who are Medicaid patients and treat them very successfully. So it really helps for low-income people in particular.
And Medicaid does cover them.
It does, yes.
We have an email from Melissa, and I don't know whether this is perceived as a problem or not. She says, hasn't Ohio learned from the nurse practitioners battle in Ohio? Ohio was the last state to approve nurse practitioners to work in Ohio. that mid-level providers are a critical piece of care delivery to those who need it. Why is the legislature so resistant to this idea? Is there resistance to this at the state level?
Because dentists and dental therapists are licensed at the state level. So it would require a change at the state level in terms of licensure to permit them to practice.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, some states already are beginning to. So it's a national trend. It's inevitable that it will be here in Ohio and every other state eventually. But there is opposition, and largely it comes from organized dentistry, just like nurse practitioners were opposed by doctors many years ago. Now you go to a doctor's office and you're just as likely to be seen by a nurse practitioner as you are a doctor. In fact, I myself often am seen when I go to my doctor by a nurse practitioner. It's become such a part of our medical delivery system. We'll see the same thing in dentistry in the years to come.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the shortage of dentists and one strategy to address that shortage in particularly rural areas, and I would imagine particularly the areas of Appalachia and Ohio.
Yes.
My guest is Wendell Potter. He's a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Can we talk about the connection between dental health and overall health? That's why sometimes it's confusing that it's not covered by healthcare coverage that it's been separated the way it has.
It has. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's been separated historically, you know, for many, many years. The mouth is almost treated as if it's not really a part of the rest of the body. But there is a close connection between oral health and overall health. If you don't have healthy teeth and gums, it creates an inflammation that can lead to heart problems, and an abscessed tooth can lead to inflammations that can actually go to your brain. And a lot of people die every year because of abscessed teeth and gums, because the infection becomes so pervasive, spreading from the gums to the other parts of the body, that the body just doesn't have the ability to resist it.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the 2 years for a dental therapist, what the training would involve. What kind of training do they go to? It's 2 years of what?
It's 2 years of very intensive training, and it's nonstop. It goes through the calendar year. I've seen the training in person in Alaska, which was the first state to allow dental therapists in this country to practice. Keep in mind, they've been practicing in other countries for almost 100 years. In fact, there are 50 other countries, including most of the developed countries in the world, that do allow them and encourage them to practice because it meets a great need. Their training is specific to that scope of practice, and they actually get more training in the areas that they're trained for than dentists do. So to say that they are not trained adequately is absolutely not true. Some of the opponents of dental therapy say that they try to suggest that it's substandard care or second-class care or care that might not be safe. But that's not the case at all, because they actually, like I said, get more training than dentists do in that scope of practice. And there's not a single study that exists anywhere in the world that shows that the care is anything but effective and safe.
What's to say they would go out and practice in the areas of need anyways? Well, how does that work?
Most of the dental therapists that practice in the states right now are people who come from communities where there is not much there are not many dentists practicing right now. They typically go back into the communities where they came from, and that's why it's such a good solution for those areas. In Alaska, for example, the dental therapists there are recruited from the villages. After they're trained, they go back into those communities and they provide care to the people who were their neighbors and their relatives.
But there's no guarantee.
There's no guarantee, but in Alaska, part of the training program is paid for by the communities, and so it's part of the deal that if they if their training is at least partially paid for, and in fact mostly paid for there, then they will go back to their communities and serve as part of the arrangement.
you know, Alaska is kind of a special case because a lot of the communities are very isolated, but they're not necessarily very poor. They're just isolated, and it's hard to – and they can afford to do that. There's areas of Appalachia and Ohio that they're isolated and they're very poor.
It's exactly right.
It'd be very expensive to do this.
Yeah. We think of Alaska as being, you know, as a state that is almost like another country that's so far away and has such different needs. But if you're living in Appalachia, where I came from, you might as well be living in a remote island off of the coast of Alaska, because if you don't have much money and you live a pretty far distance away from the nearest dentist, you're just not going to get the care that you need. And that's a big problem. It's a problem to taxpayers, because a lot of those people, they forego their care, but their teeth continue to get worse, and they'll wind up in many cases in emergency rooms. 800,000 people go to emergency rooms for dental care every year in this country, and that's not an appropriate place for getting dental care. It's a very expensive place. A lot of them can't pay their bills, so taxpayers pick up that tab.
Is there a potential for a continuum here? The American Dental Association hasn't endorsed accreditation for this position. They don't think that dental therapists should do extractions, for one thing. So what about dental therapists that can't do extractions, can't do fillings, but they could do cleanings? I guess it's a dental hygienist.
Well, it's a dental hygienist, and that's not meeting the need. And it's not a very responsible position, because they're not recognizing that, like I said, dental therapists get more training in the areas in which they are the scope of practice than dentists do. So they are very, very well qualified. I wouldn't have the slightest hesitation to have a dental therapist fill it, a tooth, do a filling or an extraction of mine. I've seen them in practice, and I know that they are absolutely capable and well-trained.
Do we know where things have gone wrong for patients being worked on by dental therapists?
No. No. And that's the thing. I've been at meetings in which representatives of the ADA, the American Dental Association, have been asked, where are the studies? What can you show us that this is not safe? And there is not a single study. They cannot come up with anything. They are very safe. And in Alaska, they've been now working for 10 years and without complaints, without problems, without any litigation, and with very high marks. They are really meeting a great need. And some of those communities, some of the children are cavity-free in these communities for the first time ever.
So you said Alaska. Are there other places in the country that have adopted this?
Yes. Minnesota.
Accreditation?
Exactly. Minnesota was the second state. Maine last year became the third. Many states are looking to do the same thing to enable them to practice. Ohio is one of them. But states from coast to coast are looking at it because it's a free market solution as well. It doesn't require any new taxes or government programs, but it's a way to actually increase the number of jobs in a given community.
Mm-hmm. And the American Dental Association has said it's opposed to accreditation for these positions. But what is your sense? What do we know about dentists in general?
Well, a lot of dentists are, like I said, they practice a lot in wealthy areas, and so they're just not able to or willing to go into areas where there is a great deal of need. And I think most dentists certainly want to do the right thing. A lot of dentists have become champions of dental therapists. It's not that there are not dentists who are supportive. The American Dental Association still is on record as being opposed, but more and more dentists, and I've met many of them, recognize that they can be a part of the dental team. And they are. When they practice, they are a part of the dental team. And studies have shown as well that where they are working with dentists, whether it's in Alaska or Minnesota, that they actually can bring in more revenue to more than pay for their positions. And that frees up the dentist to do more work at the top of his or her scope of practice. In other words, the dentist can do more complicated procedures that bring more income into their practice.
So you're talking about dental therapists as working as part of a team. They wouldn't be independent?
That's right. They can. They're part of a dental team.
Is it required that they be part of a dental team? Okay.
Yes, required. They have to be supervised by a dentist. They don't have to be right next in the next chair to the dentist. They can operate. They can work remotely. And work through teledentistry. But again, if they encounter a patient with a problem that is beyond their ability to treat, they immediately refer that patient to a dentist, and they can do through the teledentistry show the dentist what they have encountered in that, at that particular patient.
Can they prescribe?
They can. Yes.
Okay.
Can.
Like a nurse practitioner, yes, can write,
right,
prescriptions.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Wendell Potter. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Anne.
Oh, we've been talking about the lack of dental care in the United States in certain regions, and one option for it is the role of a new mid-level dental practitioner called a dental therapist. Wendell Potter is a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity. He will be speaking tonight in Columbus. For more information on that, you can go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link for you. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Experts recommend we drink about 8 glasses of water a day. For many people, carrying a water bottle makes it easy to stay hydrated. But a few years ago, a controversial chemical found in plastic water bottles came under scrutiny. Bisphenol A, or BPA, thank you, has been banned in many baby bottles, but still finds its way into the objects we touch every day. Joining us now by phone for more on this and other health topics is the chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So what is BPA? Where do we find it the most?
Well, it was found the most in hard containers, so those water bottles that we use for backpacking and carrying around, those typically had BPA in them. And a lot of the baby bottles that were hard containers also had it in those. But as you mentioned, in the baby bottles, that's been discontinued as of 2012. But you can still find BPA practically everywhere. It's in metal cans, food and beverage containers, paper receipts. There are billions of pounds of it produced every year in the world.
What's the problem with it?
Well, the problem is believed to be related to what's called endocrine disruption. That is, BPA has a chemical structure similar to some of the chemicals in our bodies that work to really influence our endocrine system. Particularly, BPA is very similar to estrogen in terms of its effects. And so the worry is that this could especially have a profound effect on the fetus and newborns, but also in very young children. Now, I want to say that we reviewed really carefully the literature on BPA, and the vast majority of the science behind the worries about BPA are from what are called observational studies. That is, studies that we observe different groups, but you can't prove causality from those.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been a lot of studies in animals and test tubes. So we're not on real firm scientific ground when we talk about the worries, but we're also not on real firm scientific ground when we say that it's safe.
Right. I mean, it's been banned in baby bottles, so there's some legitimate concerns.
There are legitimate concerns. There really are. I think that, you know, the science that we have, as I was saying, although not as solid as we'd like, has raised some real red flags.
I was surprised when you mentioned metal bottles. I thought this was a plastic or part
it's
of...
It's a plastic, but it's not some... And when I was saying metal, what I was really referring to were like cans. So the canned beverages that we drink from,
mm-hmm.
Canned foods, most of those cans are lined with BPA. Now, you can occasionally find BPA-free cans, but they're very unusual. So one of the ways we get BPA, one of the probably three big ways we get it, is through canned foods and canned drinks.
I know exactly what kind of lining you're talking about, and it helps make the food taste better when it comes out of a can, but it's still being used for that now, and that's pretty common.
It's very common. I mean, yeah, just a lot of people have drink beverages out of cans. A lot of the food products we use are canned.
Right.
Now, again, I don't want to frighten people away from canned foods. They're a wonderful source of foods and usually relatively inexpensive and often nutritious. So just pay attention to that. One thing that, of course, one can do to obviate that is to try and not use canned, use bottles that don't have any of the lining in it. But that's, again, hard to find.
And as far as drinking water bottles go, a lot of people still use the pre-packaged drinking water bottles. Do those have BPA in them?
No.
Okay.
Most of those don't. They have different polycarbonate in them. What you should look for on the bottom is typically the recycle number 7 in the triangle. If that's there, that's typically BPA, and okay. That's what you should avoid.
Studies have found that hand sanitizer increases absorption of BPA. What do we know about that?
Right. So we've talked about the polycarbonate plastics, and we talked about the cans, but this is more recent evidence that these thermal papers that we get from receipts actually have BPA in them. You can tell if they do because if you scratch those receipts that you get and they turn dark, then you know there's BPA in it. And there have been a couple of studies in the last 2 years that have suggested that people who handle these thermal receipts a lot do have higher levels of BPA in their bodies. And then there was one really interesting study, Jen, less than a year ago that showed that if you have alcohol sanitizer on your hand that hasn't completely dried and then handle the thermal paper, that even increases the amount of BPA you're going to get. So there are some concerns about thermal paper. I would consider it, and looking at the literature today, it's one of the three big areas, the polycarbonate plastics, the cans, and the thermal paper. It's one of the three big areas where we get BPA.
Now, when you talk about these thermal papers, that's the same kind of thing that we used in fax machines for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's right. But today where we see it is in receipts when you go to the store.
Right.
So certainly somebody working at the counter is going to get a lot of that on their hands. But again, studies have shown that if you just handle it a lot, if you handle those receipts a lot that are in your pocket or in your purse, you're going to get BPA on your hands as well.
Okay, something to watch for, something to avoid if you can. Are there any other ways to... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that avoid if you can is really the problem. You know, people are concerned about it, as we've been talking about, so people have been looking for safer alternatives. And frankly, we're not sure that there are safer alternatives. Some of the things that chemicals that are going into our hard plastic bottles today that say BPA-free, well, they have other polycarbonates in them that may be just as risky. So we're in a bad position right now where we don't have enough science to guide us.
Okay. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with Dr. John Swartzberg. He's chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. If you have a question or comment about one of the topics we bring up today, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You wanted to talk about herbal dietary supplements. We've done it before. We'll do it again. They've taken a big credibility hit lately. Some major brands were found to contain none of their featured product, and the spring-summer issue of the Wellness Letter addresses supplements A to Z. What are a few of the supplements we might actually need?
Right. Well, we looked all the way from A to Z at supplements, and we did find 5 that you may need. One, of course, is calcium, that I think most people know about that, and we need to get an adequate amount of calcium in our diet, and a lot of people don't get it from food. It's always better to get your calcium from food, but if you can't get it from food, you may need to take a calcium supplement. You want to aim for around 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams per day on average. Again, try to get it by food, but if you can't, you may need a supplement. So that's one. Another one, and tied to calcium, of course, is vitamin D. A good way to get vitamin D is by sunlight, but during the winter we can't get it. And sunlight has its own downside in terms of skin cancers. It's hard to get enough vitamin D from diet alone, but you can if you concentrate on that. But if not, a supplement probably is worthwhile. Folic acid is the third that's very important. We've known for a long time that adequate levels of folic acid in your body when you get pregnant and during pregnancy prevent some really serious problems to the fetus. So that's terribly important. And obstetricians always have their patients when they're pregnant taking folic acid mm-hmm. supplementation. So that's another area. The last two are a little more iffy. Vitamin B12 is not hard to get as long as you eat the flesh of animals. But, you know, a lot of people don't want to eat the flesh of animals, and then it becomes more difficult. If you're a vegan, it's very difficult to get an adequate amount of vitamin D, and you may need to take a vitamin B12 supplement. Mm-hmm. So that's one area of concern. Also, as we get older, we don't absorb a lot of the vitamins as well, especially B12. And so perhaps older people should be taking a B12 supplement. That's more debated. There's not a lot of good science for that. Finally, the last one that we said you may need is a multivitamin mineral pill. There are a few people who probably should have this. I mentioned if you're pregnant and getting adequate folic acid, usually one does that by taking a multivitamin. If you're breastfeeding, it would be the same case. Strict vegetarians, I mentioned B12, but also zinc and iron may be sometimes a problem, so a multivitamin with minerals might help there. People on prolonged weight loss diets probably need supplementation, and maybe older people because they don't absorb as well. I want to just say one thing about multivitamins and mineral pills is there's actually no good science behind the recommendation that people take these. So the recommendations that I was just suggesting are based upon what we think we know, but there's not a lot of science behind that.
And, you know, like I said earlier, there are issues about what's in those bottles in the first place. Some major brands were found to contain none of their featured products. So what recommendations do you have for people when they're looking for a supplement?
Yeah, you know, I get that question all the time, and I don't have a really good answer. And the reason I don't have a good answer is because there are not sufficient controls on the supplement industry. You mentioned the recent concerns that were brought out from New York State, mm-hmm. But also a year before that, there was a very good study done in Canada that showed major supplement and herbal manufacturers that they didn't contain what they had in them, a lot of the products. So there's no way of knowing with absolute assurance, like you would know if you got a prescription pill in the United States, whether you're getting what you want. That said, the standard advice has been to buy from companies that are established, that are large companies that would have a lot more to lose from not having good manufacturing practices. I wish I could give better advice than that, but until our society recognizes that this $30 billion or so a year industry that is hardly regulated at all needs more regulation, that's the best advice I can give.
Okay, let's turn to sleep apnea. We talk a lot about sleep on this show. Seems like nobody's getting enough these days. Sleep apnea causes disruptions in nighttime breathing. It affects about 10% of Americans. And you can do a rough scan of your risk factors just by looking in the mirror. What can people look for?
Yeah, sleep apnea is a lot more common than people think. And if you have it, getting it corrected will make your life not only much better from a health standpoint, but you'll actually feel a lot better when you're getting an adequate amount of sleep. One of the things you can do is to, as you said, look in the mirror. Because if our tongues are too large, it's a precipitant for apneic episodes. If our maxilla, the upper jawbone, is too small, that can precipitate it. If the lower jawbone, the mandible, is too large, an overbite, that will precipitate it. If you have a real thick neck, or a deviated septum in your nose. Those are some other things. So, and you can see all those things by looking in the mirror. Look, hold a light up to your nose and see if it looks like the septum is straight. If it doesn't, talk to your doctor about that. You can tell if you have a thick neck. In a man, if it's more than 17 inches or 16 inches in a woman, it's probably too thick, and that can precipitate apnea. If you have a big overbite or underbite, that's a problem. But the best thing to do from looking in the mirror is look at your tongue. if you stick your tongue out, you should be able to see that uvula, that little tissue that drops down in the middle of the back of your throat, and you should easily be able to see that. If you can't see it when your tongue is sticking out, then your tongue may be too large and may be precipitating apnea, and that's something you should check out with your doctor.
Okay, but what do you do if your tongue's too large?
Well, frankly, the last resort is surgery. CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure, works very well for that particular problem. There's also a newer prescription device that hasn't been studied as well called Provent, which goes into your nose, and that can help a lot too. So those are a couple of things that doctors can do for you. But some things you can do for yourself are limiting the amount of alcohol you drink, because that makes the muscles in the back of your throat much less likely to contract normally and therefore precipitating apnea. Avoid sedating medications. Don't eat a lot before you go to sleep. And of course, stop smoking if you're smoking. A couple of easy tricks are to lie on the side. Don't sleep on your back, but sleep on the side or on your tummy. And that makes it harder for the tongue to obstruct. And you can also elevate the head of your bed a little bit, and that also can help a little somewhat. So those are some tricks you can do, and I would certainly recommend those for anybody with any degree of apnea. But if you need more than that, you need to talk to your doctor.
And just a regular doctor, or will you probably be referred to a specialist?
I think you'd probably be referred to an ear, nose, and throat specialist. There are also doctors who are sleep specialists who are well-trained to identify apneic problems. So one of those two specialists are probably the way to go.
Some people aren't aware that they have sleep apnea. They aren't aware that they are waking up.
Right. Most people actually aren't. Partners, if you're sleeping with someone, knows, because you're often snoring, but some people with sleep apnea don't snore, so even that won't tell you. If there's any question about it, you can have a sleep study. These can be done in particular offices where you spend the night, but that's not very pleasant. Perhaps a little less accurate, but maybe a good screening tool is these studies can be done at home now. So again, that's something you and your doctor can talk about. Some of the tips that you may have sleep apnea, besides the idea of snoring or your partner hearing you stop breathing for a while, are if you have high blood pressure, if you're tired during the day a lot, more so than you think you should be, if you're having any rhythm disturbances of your heart, those are often tip-offs that you may be having apnea during the night.
And then real quick, we wanted to talk about, you went to school for a long time to become a physician, but you recently evaluated some health-related folk wisdom, the stuff our grandparents may have clung to. For instance...
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, I bet it was, because there's something to some of it, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. You know, there some of the old sayings, you know, the one that I always heard, of course, and most of us did, was an apple a day keeps the doctor away. So we looked into where that came from. It probably came from 19th century Wales, where they used to say, eat an apple on going to bed and you'll keep the doctor from earning his bread. And that wasn't too far from the truth. It's not that apples are so incredibly nutritious. They're reasonably nutritious, but not more so than other fruits and vegetables. But what's good about eating an apple is it often fills you up. It's a nutritious snack as opposed to a lot of the non-nutritious snacks that people are eating. There was a really fun sort of tongue-in-cheek study in the British Medical Journal in 2013 that estimated that if Britons over 50 ate an apple a day, it would do as well as if they were taking a statin a day in terms of preventing heart attacks. Again, it was tongue-in-cheek, but the message was there. Yeah. So eating an apple a day is reasonable. I think maybe we should change it to saying eating a fruit a day, at least several servings of fruit a day.
And briefly back to the apnea issue, early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. We know that from Poor Richard's Almanac by Benjamin Franklin.
Right, and he apparently got it from, we found it going back all the way to the 15th century. But interestingly, the science today suggests that some people who stay up late actually do very well, and some people who get up very early do very well. So the bottom line to that is whatever works for you, whatever
okay.
makes you the most comfortable.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, thanks for joining us as always.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Dr. John Swartzberg, he's chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Thanks to the Allside staff, including assistant producer Rachel Quimby, who produced this show. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.